So I've lost my omsay.
Venerable
Lama has gone to Western North Carolina, so I have to improvise. Do you want to do it, Aaron? Okay, Allie, you can do it. We'll just make it up. All right. So a good way to start. Actually, when Lama Yeshe, who's he's Lama Zopa's guru, and really he and Lama Zopa founded the FPNT. When I first met him many years ago, he would keep, people would say, Lama Yeshe's coming at 6, or let's say 7. Well, it'd be like he'd show up at 8. But people would start saying mantras, Tayata, Om Mani Padme, to keep the mind positive. So let's start out with do Tayata. Tayata Om Mani Padme Maha Manaye Soha. It's on the first page. Now, here's how you can think of this mantra. It's Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. That's a historical Buddha that lived about 25 to 2600 years ago. I'm not going to translate it because I cannot remember exactly what it means anyway, but the point of it is it's not important to know the literal meaning of it, but to think of it as a package, like when like all the Buddha's teachings are subsumed, so to speak, in this mantra. Everything that the Buddha ever taught for 60 years is summarized in this mantra. So when you say that, you can sort of feel like you're connecting with the entire Buddha's teachings as we say this. And we'll do this, we'll do it like 21 times. I have 21 beads on this thing, so we'll do it like that. Tayata Om Mane Mane Maha Manaye Soha. 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 I remember we had children with us. That was 7 times. Okay, so let's do the 4 measurables prayers together. And again, and everything has meaning. So the 4 measurables. These are called mudras, when you hold your hands a certain way and stuff like that. So we do a mudra that where you hold your, and this is every spiritual tradition does this, don't they, just about? I mean, where people hold their hand at their heart. And I think it's to try to help the mind, help us speak from the heart, so to speak. So if you put your hands together at your heart when you say these prayers, the first one has to do with happiness and the cause of happiness, that's love, that's great love. Suffering and causes of suffering, to be free from that, that's compassion. And then immeasurable happiness, free from suffering. And then equanimity is the last one. So each of these lines has a profound meaning. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then we go down to the refuge formula, refuge in bodhicitta. And I always tell people, before you just launch into this refuge prayer, you need to think about why you're doing it. And from those of you who are Buddhists or maybe aspiring Buddhists, there's an attitude that you have when you go for refuge. You've decided this is a path that you want to commit to. So you want to reflect on at least two things. One is that with the kind of mind you have, you're in trouble. We're all in trouble. We're all in big trouble because we don't have any control over our minds. Even though we can't even sit here for 2 seconds, you know, for a minute and focus. And our mind is sort of constantly churning up problems for us. So we have to understand that the future for us, with the kind of mind we have, which is out of control, is going to be very difficult. And so we need to have some dread, some sense of dread for what we would call a future that's uncontrolled, with a mind that's uncontrolled. So we have to have, oh my gosh, I need some help. We have to understand that we're sick, okay, in a sense, in this broad sense. We don't have suffering and happiness come from the mind, and our mind is completely out of control most of the time. You don't have to buy that, but you can just check it out. Anytime you try to meditate for a minute, your mind's all over the place, isn't it? So we have some dread for the future, living with a mind out of control, and we have confidence that the Buddhas, the enlightened beings and our potential to be enlightened, excuse me, the Dharma, which are not just the books, but the realizations in the minds of beings and our potential to gain those realizations, and the Sangha, theoretically, I guess, are really those beings that have had seen emptiness directly. Also, the beings that are monks and nuns are considered to be, you know, pure Sangha. But we're all Sangha. You know, we support one another in the path. So our potential to be a support for others. So we take, you know, so we have confidence and also in compassion. That's another Mahayana perspective on refuge, is that we're going to refuge based on our wish to really be helpful to all living beings, based on compassion. And we need a strong support to develop our mind in this way. So with sort of a sense of dread of having a mind that's out of control and the problems that's going to bring us in the future, a sense of confidence, or you might call it faith, confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and compassion, the power of compassion. And then, with these attitudes, then we say these lines, like the refuge in bodhicitta. So we'll do that now. I go for refuge in till I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Okay. So, I think we can let the children's go. Is that enough? So the students here, these are the, how many people were at Rinpoche's teachings yesterday? Okay. So, you know, I wanted to touch on that a little bit, but also to, since we have people that are sort of just got off the boat, so to speak, brand new are you brand new to Buddhism? I think people just never know nothing about Buddhism. This is a very, very first exposure. So don't want to leave you people in the dust. You know, and it's not hard because most everything in Buddhism is practical, I think, or can be made practical. So we'll try to make it meaningful. So let's start out with meditation. And the word meditation is, some people think it's to space out, you know, just to empty your mind. But it really means to familiarize yourself with something. Usually the way you want to familiarize, sometimes the object is neutral, sometimes it's positive, but you don't want to, we already know how to focus on negative stuff, right, and familiarize ourselves with, I hate him, I hate him, I hate him, I hate him, I hate him. That's a kind of a meditation, but not really. That's not the one we want to do. So we want to familiarize ourselves with something that's going to strengthen our mind. So we're going to start out with just watching the breath. Geshe-la has taught many of you how to do your 9-round breathing, so if you want to do that, if you want to do the counting of the breath, if you're brand new, maybe easiest just to try to focus on the sensation of the breathing at the tip of the nose. And we'll do that for just a few minutes, but if you're new to this, it'll feel like an eternity. And then we'll do a little guided meditation to set the motivation for the morning, and then we'll go from there. So sit up straight, put both feet on the ground, your back, you want your spine kind of like a coin stacked one on the other, your vertebrae, even though the spine really is curved, isn't it? But you want to pretend like your spine is like a stack of coins. And your hands can go in your lap. There are different ways to do it. Or you can, one mudra is to put the right hand on top of the left, the thumbs together, and you want your thumbs at the level of the navel, like that. So just bring your, do whichever practice to help settle your mind. Your mind wanders, which it inevitably will do, you just simply bring it back and start again, focusing on the breath. Just simply the inhalation and exhalation, something that we do all the time. So this type of meditation where we focus the mind has great potential to bring peace and happiness to our mind. But it's not the ultimate goal of meditation. It's just to have a peaceful, happy mind. The ultimate goal of meditation is to wake up, is to see things clearly, and to achieve our full potentials. So to do that, we have to bring some sort of contemplative or analytical practice into our meditation. And one simple one that we do that is at the very heart of Tibetan Mahayana Buddhism, which is what we practice here, is based on something called the awakening mind, bodhicitta, lots of different terms to describe it. But in the essence of it is that we practice as our goal for practice is not just our own happiness, but the happiness of all living beings. That's our sort of ultimate intention. It's kind of like if we want to climb Mount Everest, we think, okay, that we want to get to the top of Mount Everest. So everything we do is aimed at getting us to that supreme goal of enlightenment, in this case, where we can be a perfect servant to others, guide them and support them in every way possible. So to do that, we have to get our act together. We have to eliminate our anger, jealousy, pride, arrogance, irritability, depression, anxiety, and so on. We have to eliminate that gradually, slowly, slowly, and build up positive mind states, love, compassion, empathy, kindness, humility, and so on. So one easy way, I think, one simple way to do this, or at least it helps my mind, is to start out by thinking, everybody wants exactly what I want. Everybody wants to be happy, and nobody wants to suffer. The person you came here with, or the people around you right now, everybody in this room, outside this room, everybody on the planet, every living being wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. We're all exactly the same. So we're all equal. My happiness is not more important than your happiness. We all equally want happiness and to avoid suffering. And then from the Buddhist perspective, there is a cause for happiness and there is a cause for suffering. The cause for suffering is one demonic state of mind. It's called self-cherishing selfishness. We'll all recognize this. It's the state of mind that thinks, I am the most important one. It's all about me. I, me, you know? Even particularly when we experience strong emotions or depressed, it's total self-absorption, isn't it? I don't like feeling this way. I can't stand being anxious. I can't I shouldn't feel this way. So on and so on. But it's always I. I want that. I don't want that. All of our suffering comes from self-cherishing selfishness. And it puts us at odds with everybody else in the world, in the universe, in fact. Because we think we're the center of the universe. We think it all starts with me and I. At our heart of hearts, that's our instinct. And we have at this point, at least for me, I can't speak for you, but for me, I have no control over that instinctive sense of I and how I cling to it and exaggerate it, and it causes all kinds of problems. And then the cause of happiness is the flip side of this mind that focuses inward on I, is called cherishing others. Cherishing others. So Buddhism would say that for happiness, cherish others. Focus outward. Dedicate your life to others. Be in service to others. Completely give yourself to others. And if you can do that with a pure motivation, not with some expectation of something in return, that is the cause of happiness. That is the cause of happiness. The devil is the self-cherishing selfishness. That's the source of all the suffering. The cause of happiness is the heart that's completely dedicated to the welfare of others. And then we can do a mentally kind of a switch this attitude. Of course, it's just something that we're practicing with our mind, but as much as possible, we want to be able to exchange our selfishness for the mind that cherishes others. So we sort of mentally think, okay, now, instead of being totally, self-absorbed, me, I, I'm going to focus on others. What can I do for others? How can I help others? We keep our body healthy for others. We might, get up in the morning and shower and put on nice clothes and try to look our best for others. We go to work and work for others. We eat healthily and we exercise our body to keep it healthy so we can serve others. So we try to transform every action of our body, speech, and mind into something that's focused on the welfare of others. This is called exchanging self-cherishing with cherishing others. And the next contemplation is called the Supreme Wish. And it's, it sort of seems ridiculously impossible. But it is the attitude of a bodhisattva, a real spiritual warrior, someone someone who's completely embraced this attitude called the awakening mind or bodhicitta. They think, okay, I am personally responsible for the happiness of all beings throughout space and time. I'm responsible for the happiness of my children, my spouse, my friends, my co-workers, the people I dislike, my enemies, every single living being. I am personally responsible for their happiness, for guiding them from their present state of confusion all the way to supreme enlightenment. And it's not based on some egomaniacal, I'm the greatest kind of attitude. It doesn't come from that. If it does, it's not the supreme wish. It comes from genuine feeling of interconnectedness with all beings, seeing the interdependence of everything, based on love and compassion. So from that perspective, where we feel interconnected and we want others to be happy and to be free from suffering, and in our, it is our greatest wish in our heart of hearts that that happen, then we realize this, you know, it's my job. I take personal. It's not Lama Zopa's job. It's not Geshe-Kelek's job. It's not Robbie Watkins' job. It's my job. We think that we have to have that kind of heroic attitude. It's my job. I'm personally responsible for the happiness of others. Seems like too much, doesn't it? But this is where we need to practice. It takes time. Effortful in the beginning. Effortless with time, but effortful in the beginning. And then the next step is called the generation of bodhicitta, or the generation of the awakening mind. We think, okay, I want that. In my heart of heart, I want to be able to do that. But I can't do it. I don't even have control over my own mind and body. So we think, okay, I'm going to do the work. It's kind of like, you want to be a heart surgeon? Okay, you got to do the work. You got to, you know, you got to make good grades in school. You got to go through probably 10 years of residency, and then you show up at Wake Med or wherever, and you can do heart surgery. But if you go over there now just because you want to do it, and you've got a great motivation to do it, and you really think you know, your motivation's pure, but you haven't done the work. You haven't developed your qualities and eliminated your mistakes, then you're likely to cause a lot of havoc. And so a bodhisattva, someone who has this attitude, understands that they have to practice the path. I must become enlightened for the sake of others. So I must practice the path. And the Buddha taught it and packaged it. And as Venerable Rubina calls it, packaged it a lot of different ways. But in general, it's renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom, with having the correct view of reality. And the Lamrim teachings that we teach here, that Geshe-Kelek teaches and are taught in different classes, are all aimed at different steps along the path. There is a method. It's not just do it. It's like, okay, there's specific practices and things to learn and think about and meditate on that will transform our mind from its present state of confusion into that of a supremely happy being. But there's work to be done. There's work to be done. So we set our mind on this ultimate goal of helping others, and the method to do that is to develop ourselves through practicing the path. So without thinking this or that anymore, just hold on to whatever experience that you have by doing these contemplations. impacts your concentration. Several things I can talk about, actually. And any questions? Let's start first with questions from yesterday or anything. Any questions that people have, then I'll launch into something. I don't have forever, about 30 minutes. Yeah.
It seems to me that, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That a certain amount of our karma is out of our control if it's based on past lives. Mm-hmm. And I don't really understand that. So how do we, it seems like we're not totally responsible for our past lives. I mean, maybe we are, but maybe we're not. I don't understand that.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have that question? What'd you come up with, David?
Well, I think I've been studying here more or less for 10 years. I guess I have a general idea of what Buddhist thinking is about. I think the past lives and the karma from that, the idea there is that, let's say you're trying to find an explanation for why some poor child has a terrible disease, or why some great misfortune has happened to you, or why things seem so unsatisfactory, and part of it may be things that happened in past lives that you can't remember, but which have carried forward with your consciousness as it's born in your current body, and that's how the mechanism works. And, you know, I guess as far as what you can change, you can try to be positive and do good things in your current life to make your future as positive as possible. But you may have to purify, or you may have to suffer some from things that happened in the past, perhaps in this life or even in future and in past lives. And, you know, my thinking is whether you think karma carries from one life to another, is it doesn't actually matter. Buddhism has important good thoughts about it either way. If you think, well, all I can do is influence the rest of this life, you work on that. And then if you think the good things I do in this life are going to carry forward into the next one, then maybe that's a positive thought for you too.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if that answered your question, but I have a little take on it too. That what you're really talking about is responsibility, isn't it? Am I responsible for being a woman, being a man, having... you know, some sort of congenital problem, having a tendency toward depression or addiction, or, you know, driving down the road and some drunk hits me and head on and I'm a quadriplegic. I mean, my gosh, is there any end to responsibility here? Right? I mean, from the Buddhist perspective, Lama Zopa was even saying yesterday, if you're in a tsunami, you know, it's even environmental things. Everything is created by the mind. Ultimately, this is hard to take, but it is part of the Buddhist perspective that happiness and suffering depend on our mind. Now, that is crucial. That is crucial for us to get. Now, the notion of responsibility, what is the experience of feeling? I'm just going to say, let me give an example first. So two women, this is a class that I taught many years ago, and Joanna Smith was in it, and Bill Judge was there. These are the early days. Anyway, there were two women. We were at the Universal Fellowship, and we were all sitting on the floor because there were not even any Christians there, and there were a couple of women sitting side by side, and I was talking about karma and responsibility and past and future lifetimes. And one woman talked about how she'd been raped by her father, and literally, and she was about 30 years old, and she'd been in therapy, and I think she was on a lot of medicine too, and she really had suffered a lot, and so she was enraged by the notion that she would be responsible for something that happened to her as a small child. But responsibility, from the Buddhist perspective, doesn't mean she's to blame. You can't blame a four-year-old, right? Or a newborn baby for what they have. It is just what it is. But this lady said, I just can't buy that. And sitting right next to her was another lady. And she said, I remember it like yesterday. She said the exact same thing had happened to her. She'd been raped by her dad repeatedly, blah, blah, blah. And it literally defined her until she was in her late teens. And then at some point she went to a workshop someplace and they talked about the choice. You can either choose to feel responsible for your life or you can choose to be a victim. What's the experience of being a victim? Low energy. You can never forgive, can you? If you're a victim, it's almost virtually impossible to forgive the person who did you wrong. It feels icky. It's very negative, right? Feeling like a victim is a very weak. I don't know. Give me some words here. Help me, huh? Helpless. Yeah, helpless. Feeling. Pardon? Permanent. How about being responsible, taking responsibility for your life? Doesn't that feel a little bit more powerful? I'm responsible for my life. Well, this lady, she said she chose, and she didn't talk about karma, right? She didn't understand karma. They didn't teach karma at this workshop. But it was a choice that she had to either be a victim or responsible. She said, I made a conscious choice to take responsibility for my life. And everything fell away. I mean, the heaviness of what had happened. She'd been blaming. She sort of gave up on that and just said, look, I can't change that, but I've got a chance to create a future for myself. And so she chose this route, co-responsibility. Now, if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty of responsibility from a Buddhist perspective, what really supports the notion of responsibility? Karma, right? What goes around comes around. If you want to be responsible, if we want to be responsible for our lives, then what do we need to do? You know, Lama Zopa says we can, neuropsychologists now talk about neuroplasticity. It's like our mind is not, we're not just stuck with this solid chunk of brain and chemistry. We can actually create new synapses, change the brain chemistry by the way we think. So Lama Zopa was saying this years before the neuroscientist was saying it. He was saying we can shape our mind and our future, because our mind creates our future, we can shape it by the choices that we make. So from a Buddhist perspective, what goes around comes around. Always, never, ever does it. Every action of body, speech, and mind creates imprints that will ripen tomorrow, maybe, next week, next month, or 50 eons from now. But right this minute, for us to have the experience of being at Kadampa Center, based on what I just said, what's happening? What's happening for each of you? Because we each are having our different experiences, right? What's happening for you right now? Let's hear from the back of the room. Based on what I said, how in the world could you find yourself here? Listening to this blah, blah, blah. Anybody want to speak? David wants to. Yeah. We want to shape our future. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say we're just taking responsibility because we're looking for something better.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and to get back to karma, I mean, if this is now, and of course now is not ever a fixed point. Now is always the next moment, isn't it? But from the perspective of karma, karma is definite. So Lama Zopa was talking about this. Everything that we do now, every little action of generosity, every little action of being mean and hateful and spiteful and so forth, every time we can never take a vacation from karma. Karma is always, as Rabina said, karma takes care. If we want our future to be positive, then we have to create positive merit, virtuous actions. You know, this could have been 50 eons ago, and here I am experiencing the ripening of the karma of being at Kadampa Center right now listening to these teachings. Okay? Right now, we would say billions of karmic seeds are ripening, forcing you to be listening to me and forcing me to say what I say. You know, our karma, you can't change what just happened, can you? You can't change it. And if I'm sitting here drilling on your third molar and I hit a nerve root and it hurts like the devil, you can't change that. That's your karma ripening. You're having an experience of pain. So karma is constantly ripening. We all woke up this morning to see the sunrise, right? And to experience today. That took billions of really good karmic seeds to make it into today. Some people in this room may not make it to tomorrow. Somebody might die. Really. Might not have the karma to finish the day out. That could happen. It will happen to somebody, won't it? Someplace on this planet, people are dying all the time that didn't expect to die because their karma is finished. So that's the Buddhist perspective. It's not a blame. We're not to blame for being, you know, ugly or beautiful, smart or stupid, handicapped or not. It's not a matter of blame. Karma is like gravity. It's not personal. It's like when we create virtuous actions, like avoid killing, avoid stealing, avoid adultery, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, greed, hatred, ignorance, and there's 84,000 of them to avoid. But anyway, when we practice virtue, we create the causes literally to be forced. When we practice virtue, we're taking responsibility for our future. And we don't know when it'll happen. This is the other thing. Could be tomorrow, next week, next year, depending on the force of it, or many, many lifetimes from now. But we're actually creating the causes. So when that karma ripens, guess what? If it was virtue, we'll be forced to see ourselves as happy. If we do something mean, killing, stealing, lying, adultery, you know, harsh, frivolous talk and slander and so on, all the things that we would ordinarily consider to be destructive and harmful to others and ourselves and our mind, then we create the karma literally to be forced to see ourselves as suffering. It's not personal. Suffering is not personal. It's an impersonal, it just happens. Now, there's a lot of teachings on how to transform suffering into compassion, into the path. Well, I'm not going to talk about that now, but you're looking a little bewildered here, so let me... Yeah. Good questions, by the way.
I just had a question about that. Is it possible then to neutralize or counter the bad karma we've created with good
karma?
Great
question.
Merit?
Great question. Because this is, you know, so we've all agreed that being responsible is a better place to be than being a victim, right? Whether that's just an existential choice that you made, like this one woman who'd been raped, who had chosen to be responsible and was able to move on, and the woman who felt victimized was stuck, really stuck, and had been for 30 years. Okay, it's a choice that we can make. Now, the understanding karma really supports us to take full responsibility for our lives, even every second of our lives. Because I don't want to create more ick. I'm suffering enough as it is. I'm, you know, me personally, I am really trying to be careful all the time. And when I see my mind going off in a negative direction, I go, ouch, I don't want that. I don't want the consequences of that. I try to come back as quick as I can. You know, but that's because I mean, to the degree that, and I still don't have full faith in karma. But to the degree that we have faith in karma, the more we'll police ourselves without having, we don't need a police force, an army or whatever. If we all believed in karma, this world would be a lot different place, wouldn't it? All right. What was I saying? Merit, yeah. About how to purify karma. And so here's the deal. Merits. I must say, here's the deal 100 times a day. I do say that a lot. Anyway, what we want is merit. This is why, hang on, what time is it?
It's 20 to 12,
okay. How many people have children in the children's program? Yeah. This is why I force my kids to come here. Because they can't get merit at home. Watching Hannah Montana and playing video games. I'm sorry. They will get merit, but it won't be positive merit, usually. You know, our kids playing these, you know, kill them, bang, bang, shoot them up video games and stuff. You know, they're going to get merit, but it's going to be the merit of killing, you know, even though they're just doing it in their imagination. But merit is the cause of happiness. And this is the thing that Buddhists really, particularly at our level as lay people, but the monastics as well. Everybody wants, if you want to, we all need to be merit junkies. You know, look for opportunities to create merit. And there are objects, for example, being of service at Kadampa Center, and I'm not trying to drum up, help, but we need help. But, you know, being of service here creates a tremendous amount of merit because this is a place where people come to try to wake up and be happy and develop themselves spiritually. So a lot of people volunteer here, but they also understand that they're creating merit. And that's a good thing. We want merit. We want to, every chance you get to make an offering, make an offering. Even if there's a beggar, give the beggar a little bit of money. Big deal. You know, it's not going to hurt, you know, a dollar or two is not going to hurt you. Or something, you know, some request for money. I have to say, I don't give everybody money anymore, but I got on everybody's mailing list and then it got to be burdensome. But, you know, we want to open doors for people, pick up things for people. We want to use every opportunity we can to create merit. So doing a daily spiritual practice really helps us develop the positive merit. The mind that, and merit depends upon our intention, because karma depends upon intention. So an action that's motivated by loving kindness. Remember, Lama Zopa said, what we want is our children to develop a good heart. Well, if our kids have a good heart, then their actions come from a good heart, and it's more likely to create merit. So the whole children's program is about helping children create merit and develop positive states of mind. And my kids bitch and moan the whole time driving over here. And then when they get here, they go to their classes. And when we leave, I say, how was it? They say, oh, it was okay. I hear it time after time. I've heard it for 12 years. Off and on. But I think, you know, that's just me. And I think that this is a place where people can come and learn about how to develop and cultivate positive states of mind and decondition the negative states of mind. So merit. So what are some ways that we create merit besides what? Just simple ones.
Visiting sick people?
Yeah, positive. Yeah. Visiting sick people. Yeah. Circumambulating the stupa. You want to go around it clockwise. You could go either way, but to, you know, traditionally go around clockwise. And the stupa is a powerful spiritual symbol and object. So, you know, you could make prayers, and the prayers, you know, we say and we think the prayers are more powerful than ones that are made going around the stupa. You know, I have a friend who this morning at 11 o'clock, he and his wife and now a whole bunch of people are down at Moore's Square feeding the homeless people. Right? They open the back of their trunk and they have big pots of food because the soup kitchen and all the places that feed them on the weekends are closed. So he and his wife and his kid are feeding the homeless people. I would love to go, but it coincides with being here, so I can't go. But they do it at 11 o'clock. And they don't have any particular spiritual path, but they just feel like it's the right thing to do. And it is. So helping people that way, that's a way to create merit. Saying mantras, a way to create merit. Doing prostrations. Traditionally in Buddhism, studying, listening to the teachings, doing practices, doing a daily practice builds up the merit. Now, how do we purify? Because this is your question. Because, you know, there's a lot of karma. Let's see. If you sit down and meditate, have you ever done any a meditation retreat or anything like that? You have. So you know that. If you sit down to meditate for any period of time, you know, it's just like, you go, oh my God, I wonder who's queuing up. Because the mind just, even if you want to focus on one thing, the mind just, things just come into your mind. You have no control over what comes into your mind. Like memories of past things, you, ouch, I did that, ooh, ow, ooh. You know, and sometimes it's pain in the body, but there's all kinds of stuff that goes up and that goes on in the mind. You get pain in your knees, and you go, I hate that pain in my knees, and why can't my mind settle down? The mind completely does what it wants to do when you try to focus it. And this, gradually, you can tame it. Gradually, we can tame our mind. But in the beginning, it's like, you know, just the mind is so wild and out of control. It is really scary. So we don't have any control over what comes up in our mind. We do have something to say when it arises, whether we cling to it or whether we just let it go. We can cling to it and then feed it, and it takes us wherever it takes us, and we get distracted. Or we can just notice it and come back to the breath, or notice it and come back to the visualization that we're doing. But meditation is not easy, is it? It's hard work. So, you know, what we want to do is purify the negative karma, because it's already been created. We've already created eons of negative karma that's going to guarantee causes problems. So how do we, there's a little formula in Buddhism. Are you familiar with it? Go ahead. Yeah, so what are they? What's number one? These are called, this is worth remembering, four opponents.
The first one is regret.
Okay, I'll write that down. But you're not going to get to all four. Maybe you will.
The second one is remedy, I think.
May not be in this order, but that's okay. Yeah, keep going. The four R's, by the way. That's an easy way to remember it.
The third one is reliance. Got it reversed. Yeah.
The was resolve. Well, I would do it this way. I would put this number one, this number two, this number three, and then number four like that. But anyway, this is the point. So, all right, let's do this. Let's do this right now for just a moment. We're going to do, so the first one is the power of reliance. So we do, from a Buddhist perspective, now if you're a Christian, you could, you can rely on God or Jesus or whatever. You can invoke this in other traditions too. But as a Buddhist, we take the power of reliance is relying on something that's reliable, right? So we think as a Buddhist that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and compassion are reliable. So that's what we rely on. That's the first step. The second step is to remember what you did. So I want you right now to think about something. I know this is probably a really virtuous group of people here who have not done much of anything bad in their lives, but try to remember something that when you think about it, it makes you just go, I cannot believe I did that. Something maybe as recent as this past week. Something you might have said carelessly or something mean. Something that was definitely negative. And you gotta have, this is where we have to be really brutally honest with ourselves, you know, because we have to have, I think the Catholic word is contrition. We have to have regret. If we're in denial that we did something negative, we go, he made me do that, or I'm not responsible for that. If our ego is so attached to being right, we will not be able to generate sincere regret. And this is so crucial. The depth of our regret is crucial. And if you can't remember anything specific, you can just think of all the things I've ever done in my life that are negative, you know, that are based on killing, stealing, adultery, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, greed, hatred, ignorance, all the negative things that I've done in this life and past lives, I regret. Because I don't want to experience the karmic fruit of it. And then the next step is the step called the remedy. And sometimes you could do the resolve. But next step is usually the remedy. And so the remedy might be to pick up the phone, like in AA. I have heard that one of the things you do is you call up or you try to clean up every mess you've ever made in your life. Like you really do apologize. You do something much more significant than just say, I'm sorry I did that. You call people up. You go clean up the messes that you've made. So this would be like that, where it might require apologizing to somebody or giving some money back that you took but in Buddhism we have different methods to do it, including saying mantras, like the 100-syllable mantra, the Vajrasattva mantra, doing prostrations with visualizations, lots of meditation practices to purify. So we call it the power of the remedy. So let's say Tayata. Let's do that one like seven times. And think as we do that, that the light and nectar are coming into our body, purifying our body and mind of any karmic residua from the negative actions of the past. Tayata om mane mane maha mane so tayata om mane mane Mahamanaye Soa Dayada Omane Mane Mahamanaye Soa Dayada Omane Mane Mahamanaye Soa Dayada Mahamanaye Soa Dayata Omane Mane Mahamanaye Soa Dayata Omane Mane Mahamanaye Soa. I want to think that my body, speech, and mind have been purified by just saying this mantra and doing the visualization. And again, it doesn't preclude actually talking directly to the people. Yeah, it's important to go directly to the source if you can. But, I mean, some of these people may actually be deceased, and you can still clean up the negative karma created in relation to these people. And then the last one is some people say it's the most important one, but it's definitely important, and it's the determination to not do it again. Okay? It's not enough to say I'm sorry. In fact, they call it the cycle of abuse in psychology, I think, where you just, you know, for example, the father who sexually abuses his daughter, and he feels so regretful, and he goes, oh, I'm so sorry, but just keeps doing it over and over again, because, you know, that this thing of I'm not going to ever do it again is somehow missing, seems like. So we have to make some kind of sincere statement of intention that I'm not going to do this again. I'm not going to get angry for a minute. You don't want to lie, right? You don't want to turn around and make a lie out of it. So, if you've stolen or done something that's or kill somebody or kill something, you might say, I'm never going to kill again, or I'm never going to lie again ever. But if it's something like anger that's really that you have a tendency toward, it might just be, I'm going to do the best I can to not get angry in the next 5 minutes. I vow not to get angry for 5 minutes. But you want to do something, your resolve should be something that you can actually accomplish. And the ultimate way to purify negative karma is to have this correct view of reality called emptiness. To see that everything we've ever done is just merely labeled. It's not the truth, like with a capital T. It's just actions, things that have happened that are just merely labeled. They're not inherently true, or that's the way it is. So we have to see the emptiness of everything to completely purify every vestige of negative karma. But that takes time. But this is a really good start. So the power of reliance, the power of regret, the power of the remedy, and then resolve to not do it again. And then take on messages as much as possible. You know, we want to create causes for merit and purify our negative karma. You know, that's how we get enlightened. We create merit, build up positive potentials, and we eliminate and decondition the negative habits of mind. Everything comes from our mind. Our mind creates our world. We have to take care of it. Okay, so let's do dedication verses. went on the pink page. We can do that whole page because we've got 2 minutes. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merit. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose body are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains and as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. In the land circled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. O powerful Chinrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion, to the lotus of the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatare, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament, yellow hat traditions, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the Sudhur's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers, honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And let's do seven Tara mantras. I can never remember the tune for this, so can somebody... Tari tu re soha, om 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 tari tu re soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture So Ha. So that was dedicated to the long life of our precious teacher Geshe Gelug. Then thank you for your attention. It's 12:01 for those of you who are watching the time.